It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. All right, quick. What's 20 feet long, 8 feet wide, 8.5 feet high, and is almost literally the key to the global supply chain? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 27th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The answer to the pop quiz with which we began in just a moment. But our opening gambit today is a somewhat weedy dive into the durable goods guts of this economy. Durable goods, of course, as we have mentioned, I'm pretty sure, expensive stuff supposed to last 3 years or more. Cars, computers, airplanes, too. Also manufacturing equipment. The stuff that factories use to make the stuff that we buy. We start there because the good people at the Commerce Department reported this morning that durable goods orders were down in September. See also the everlasting gobstopper that is the global supply chain. But those orders for manufacturing equipment, core capital goods they're called, hit a record high in September, the seventh straight monthly increase. Marketplace's Justin Ho reads between the economic lines for us.
We're talking about things like drill presses, electrical equipment, metalworking tools. Manufacturers are ordering more of these things because they're trying to boost production.
We're just choked up here. We just can't get enough product out.
That's Tim Fiore with the Institute for Supply Management. He surveys manufacturers, and he says he's seeing more respondents talk about buying equipment that will help them meet consumer demand for years.
So there's a lot of runway here, and it's time that people, you know, reinvest in their equipment and facilities to address this demand. And then be ready for the next cycle.
New tools and machinery can also help a manufacturer get more efficient. That's important at a time when raw materials are hard to come by. Chad Moutre is chief economist at the National Association of Manufacturers.
Manufacturers were already doing that before the pandemic. And what we have seen is that firms have really doubled down on their investments.
Now, companies could just hire more workers if they want to boost production. But not in this labor market, says George Perks at Bespoke Investment Group.
Now, the thinking looks to be much more closer to, I want to substitute away from labor because labor is getting really expensive.
As a result of all that fancy new equipment, Burke says workers who are employed are getting more productive, and that's a good sign for the economic recovery. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
In corporate news today, Coca-Cola reported profits this morning. Revenue was up. Net income was up. Guidance for the rest of the year was up. Also up, Coke's marketing budget, nearly double from a year ago. Coca-Cola, one of the best-known brands on the planet, almost doubling its marketing budget. Marketplace's Andy Euler tries to figure that one out.
At the start of the pandemic, Coca-Cola, like most other companies, slashed costs to save cash. And Mara Einstein, professor of media studies at Queen's College, says one of the first things to get cut is the marketing budget.
Intuitively, you think, oh, this is the perfect time for me to pull my advertising. It's a way for me to help make sure that my profits look okay and all of that. It's actually exactly the opposite.
She says instead, brands, even big ones like Coca-Cola, should invest more in marketing their products.
What you want to do is make sure you are the one that is there and in front of people so that they do remember you even while things are going not so well in the economy generally.
Advertisers call it being top of mind. She says it makes sense that this year Coke spent twice as much as it did in 2020. And Jagdish Sheth, professor of marketing at Emory University, says Coca-Cola doesn't need to explain its story or tell people what kind of product they're buying.
The biggest function of advertising for a well-known brand is reminding people to use or consume the product.
Those reminders these days could be a video on Facebook or a tweet in support of a cause. Garrett Nelson at the consultancy CFRA says Coke can also handle inflation and supply chain issues better than most.
The brand has a lot of value. They've been able to successfully pass through higher costs to consumers in the form of price increases.
Because, he says, people are still willing to shell out just a little bit more for a brand they've become loyal to. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, kind of sideways. TBH might be waiting, traders might be, for our first look at July through September economic growth. That will be upon us tomorrow. As to the rest of it, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is craziness, man. This is like the dark underbelly. This is a Con Global Industries container depot in Wilmington, California, 15 or so minutes inland from the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. Yes, the ports everybody's been talking about. Yes, the ones with 77 container ships waiting to dock as of yesterday with those tens of thousands of containers full of stuff on them.
Is this good enough? I don't never Perfect. Heard the microphone before, so
there you go. It's all right. I've never been in a you know container depot. So.
Oh, okay. Well, welcome. Also, not missing much.
That's the guy in charge, Carlos Carrillo. And I guess if you come here every day, he'd be right about the not missing much thing. There is one dirt road leading to a 25-acre dirt lot with rows and rows and stacks of empty shipping containers that go on forever. But if you're just trying to understand a story like the global supply chain mess that we're having and you want to take it in bite-sized pieces, this is a pretty good place to come for today's installment of our series, Temporarily Unavailable, How Stuff Moves Around the World or Doesn't. What are we looking at here?
So this is a storage yard where we store containers. The core business here is storage and repairs. So containers
of the containers.
Of the containers. So containers come here from China with cargo. They get unloaded somewhere in LA. They terminate here before they go out, you know, going back to China or wherever it may be.
This one yard can hold 10,500 containers. They wind up here after they get offloaded off of those ships, their cargo sent wherever it's going. And the whole time I was there, trucks were coming down that long dirt road, circling one by one in front of a giant container-grabbing forklift, which sets the empties on top of one of those 40-foot-tall stacks of containers. This, I mean, yeah. I was saying this to my producer as we were waiting for you. You could get killed out here in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah. You got to be careful. That's why you wear a vest. You know, it's not going to protect you, obviously, from a falling container, but you have to be careful when we see a lift with containers in the air. I've seen it happen 3 times here already.
Really?
Where containers fallen. Luckily, no one's gotten injured, but we had...
How long have you been here?
About 15 years.
Hence, the neon yellow safety vest we had to wear. Walking around, though, some of the containers are looking pretty new, others rusty and dented and very much the worse for wear. Who owns all this, all these containers?
You have a lot of players. So leasing companies are the big corporations, big companies who own these containers. And then they put them out to lease to steamship lines or other corporations like Walmart's, Target's, you know, anyone or any corporation who needs containers to move product from China to here. So they put them out on a master lease, typically 7 years. It could be longer than that.
There's been a container shortage for a while now. Most of them are built in China, but production basically stopped for a bit because of the pandemic. The price of raw materials to make them has gone up, labor costs as well. And the bottleneck pain is not evenly distributed. Big companies like Walmart and Target have been able to pay for containers to get their stuff here from China. So a lot of the small retailers we've talked to are just being priced out. In the past year, the cost of shipping a standard container from East Asia to the West Coast of North America has more than quadrupled from less than $4,000 to almost $17,000. And that is for one container. How much does it cost to store a container here?
It's not very much. Each 40-footer, for example, maybe anywhere from $150 to $180 a day.
$150?
No, $1.50.
No, come on. $1.50 yeah. for a 40-foot container storage?
Yeah.
Something you guys like need that. To raise your prices.
I know.
Haven't you heard about inflation?
Well, leasing companies don't agree with that. But
one of the reasons we have inflation anyway, Americans want to buy stuff. A lot of stuff right now. So companies are doing what they can, including paying more to get their goods here from all over the world, which means you pay more, in part because there just aren't enough containers in circulation. Are there containers just sitting here that you're just holding for companies that don't want to use them right now or can't?
Oh, yeah. There's a bunch of containers like that that just have been sitting here for years. And that's all up to the leasing company or owners of the containers to say when they want them.
So, but this is the part I don't understand. There's a global supply chain crunch.
Right.
And part of that crunch is there aren't enough containers. Except we can see, standing here, 10,000 containers.
That is correct. How do I answer that question? Because I don't even think I understand myself why there's a shortage of containers or shortage of trucking to get these vessels.
Well, so unloaded. Trucking you get, right? Because we need truck drivers. You can only take one container at a time and all of that. But it's not actually a shortage of containers. It's a... I don't want to use a stupid supply chain word, right? But it's a bottleneck. It's a log jam. There's congestion that's not getting these 10,000 containers.
Right.
And corporate decisions as well. That's not getting these containers out of the way or out into circulation.
No, definitely trucking logistics of it is a crunch. Like you said, there is a shortage of that.
Right.
There's a shortage of space.
And that's why you can run the Port of L.A. 24/7 as long as you want.
Right.
But it's the rest of that infrastructure that's not working. There you go.
That's what it is. I'll tell you this much. About a month ago when we had these containers, these CU Lines containers being dropped off, we had a traffic jam about 3 miles out from here.
Really?
I think we had a police show up a few times to try to clear it up, but there's not much that can be done. You know, this is a very narrow road.
It is.
And these trucks need a lot of space to turn. I prefer no traffic because I want to be able to get out of here, you know, out for lunch or whatever.
Yep.
And we only have one way in, one way out.
And that is just one more small slice of why the supply chain mess is happening. At the port, it's all those ships waiting to dock. Here, it's 3 miles of trucks waiting on one dirt road to move one single container at a time. Next time on our series, Temporarily Unavailable, we'll look back at how these shipping containers became the standard for global trade anyway. That one truck, carrying that one container at a time that I was just talking about, does need one more thing, actually. It needs a driver. Trucking companies are trying to recruit. They're offering better pay and sign-on bonuses, as much as $10,000 bonuses. Despite those incentives, though, not nearly enough people want to become truckers. Or if they do, they are not in it for the long haul. Bottom line, driving a truck is hard, and it is getting harder, as Marketplace's Amanda Peacher explains.
Unlike many truck drivers who have to spend weeks away from home, Josue Alvarez goes home every night. But lately, because of port slowdowns in L.A. and Long Beach, he's stuck in his truck a lot.
A couple of days, I was just sitting in the port, just waiting for a chassis from 7 a.m. all the way to 5 p.m.
He used to be able to make 3 trips a day to and from the ports. Now he's lucky if it's one. It's stressful.
If we don't move that many load a day, we don't get paid enough.
Alvarez learned the hard way to pack lunch.
Once you're in line, if you get out, you lose your spot.
In general, there are more restrictions on drivers these days, says Zach Rogers at Colorado State University.
And it's just a much less attractive job than it was before.
In some places, drivers can't idle park trucks at night because of air quality concerns.
And I understand that, but you also don't want to be sleeping in the bed of the truck in North Dakota in December and not be able to turn the heat on.
Another frustration for drivers?
There's a shortage of parking.
George Ball carries loads of things like steel rods. He has to find parking at the end of a 14-hour drive. And if one truck stop is full, he's out of luck. He particularly dreads Dallas, Texas.
You have to go out about maybe 60 to 80 miles outside of Dallas just to be able to find a parking spot.
Ball says he's hoping to start his own trucking company so he can work on his own terms. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I feel like that's the happiest day.
Friday? Saturday? Your birthday? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial down 266 today, about 0.7%, 35,490. The NASDAQ basically flat, 15,235. The S&P 500 got rid of 23 points, about 0.5%, 45.51. The clothing rental service Rent the Runway, ticker symbol. Anybody? Come on, four letters. That's what they get. R-E-N-T, Rent. Works pretty good, right? Anyway, made its Wall Street debut today. Shares started trading at $23 a piece, moved up for a bit, but by the close, down 9%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.54%. And you, yes, you, right there, you. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One thing that hasn't happened because of the pandemic is the wave of evictions that had been predicted after the federal eviction moratorium expired last month. That's in part because states and cities have their own eviction protections in place. But now a lot of the tension is turning to rent, how high it is in a lot of places and how much higher it might be going. In big cities on the coasts, sure. Also, though, in not big cities, not on the coasts. In St. Paul, Minnesota, the average rent on a two-bedroom apartment is just about $1,300. Not New York prices by any means, but if you're a Midwesterner, the rent is too darn high. So next week, as Brita Green reports, voters in St. Paul are going to consider some new rules for rent control.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I meet Emily Lynch at a house she's renting towards the northern end of St. Paul. It's an older place, less than 1,000 square feet. Several weeks ago, Lynch's landlord gave her notice that the rent here is going up come January from about $1,200 to about $1,600 a month, an increase of more than 30%. She's now on the hunt for a more affordable place to live.
Yep, I've already been kind of looking around. It's hard to think about because it's not easy to find a place.
She says she lost her job as a steel worker early in the pandemic. She started working again this past May, but financially, she's still catching up. Her landlord, Joe Collins, says one reason he's raising the rent is to reset it to a higher rate before the city adopts possible tenant protections that would limit his ability to do so.
We knew this rent control was going to come down the pike.
He says the unintended result of proposed new regulations, including a rent control measure that'll go in front of voters citywide in next week's election, could actually be higher prices for current renters, like Emily Lynch. But tenant advocates here, including neighborhood organizer Danielle Swift, say residents need a guarantee against big hikes in their monthly bills.
We need rent control. We need rent stabilization. We need some sort of protections for tenants.
Nationwide, St. Paul is not the first city, of course, to consider rent control, but this ballot initiative is particularly stringent. Sophie House with the Housing Solutions Lab at NYU's Furman Center says if approved, it could be one of the most aggressive policies of its kind in the country.
Yeah, I think the major reason for that would be that the St. Paul proposal would apply to new construction, which is something that very few, if any, other rent regulation regimes do.
Most other rent control regulations, she says, exempt new buildings or buildings under a certain age to encourage new development. The thinking is developers will be scared away by too many controls on the prices they're able to charge. And the last thing most policymakers want to do, she says, is reduce the supply of new housing. The St. Paul proposal also limits annual rent increases to 3% with no adjustment for inflation. House says that's unusually strict as compared to policies in other areas of the country. Rent increases here have averaged just above that 3% mark over the past 10 years. That's according to average annual rent figures compiled by a local housing data and listing service. Still, many landlords are fighting hard against the change, saying it'll ultimately reduce the supply and quality of housing in the city.
Who would invest in a business that have a 3% cap on income and no cap on expenses, no factor for inflation? It's a non-starter. No one would ever do it.
Joe Abraham's company owns and manages about 300 units in St. Paul. He's expecting property taxes, utility bills, insurance costs, all to go up this year. He focuses on renovating old buildings and says the 3% cap would really tie his hands.
I can't possibly buy a building that's deteriorated, go in and spend, you know, $20,000 to $40,000 per unit and then get a $21 rent increase. Like, it just, it doesn't make sense.
Abraham is board chair of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, which represents local housing providers. They've been contributing to a political committee called the Sensible Housing Ballot Committee that's fighting the proposal. So far, it's raised almost $4 million.
Hi there. Hi. Sorry to bother.
Hi.
My name's Idalia.
The Sensible Housing Ballot Committee is paying canvassers like Idalia Vance and Jennifer Lee, who are going door-to-door trying to convince voters to vote the proposal down.
Do you have an opinion on it by any chance? Like,
their argument isn't so much that rent regulation is bad across the board, but that this specific proposal is far too strict.
People vote against it.
Just because, yeah, we think there can be better options and we want, like, a better bill written.
Ultimately, the strength of this message will be tested on Election Day. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Brita Green for Marketplace.
Used to be, before Uber and Lyft, that a taxi cab was a pretty good investment. Taxi cab medallions, specifically. Literally metal medallions that are attached to the cab itself. Permission from cities like New York and San Francisco to operate a cab. Like I said, though, that was before ride-sharing apps became a thing. And in the investment, a lot of drivers made in those medallions, huge hundreds of thousands of dollars investments, are now almost worthless. New York's got a debt relief program going for medallion owners. San Francisco does not, despite having made tens of millions of dollars selling them. A lot of the people who bought medallions are immigrants and people of color who got financing from local credit unions. And now they're on their own to deal with that debt. Sam Harnett from KQED in San Francisco has been following their story for years.
2 years ago, before the pandemic, I went to the San Francisco airport taxi lot. There, I talked with drivers who had taken out loans to buy medallions at $250,000 apiece. When Ali Ashgar got his, he threw a big party.
When we bought the medallion, I was happy. My family was happy. We celebrated. I feel like that's the happiest day in my life. I hugged my son. I hugged my wife. I hugged my kids.
For decades, taxi medallions were a sure bet. Drivers say they could earn $30 or $40 an hour and make money leasing the medallions out to other drivers. Leasing out a medallion was the de facto cab retirement plan. But with less regulated companies like Uber and Lyft taking away business, Ashgar says taxi drivers can't make enough to pay their medallion loans. Like many drivers, he borrowed money from a local credit union.
We were going through that new agreement with the finance with the bank, and I was so worried. They're right on that agreement. If you know your family, your friend, your partner, your wife, everybody, somebody has to pay this money, pay the loan to the bank.
When the pandemic began, Ashgar says taxi work completely dried up. Like many other drivers, he started working for the app companies that were competing with his taxi business. He's now driving for Lyft and Uber, along with DoorDash and Amazon. But he still owes money for the medallion. And if drivers default, they will lose everything they have already invested. So taxi driver Ali Alekhani tells me he does whatever he can to make loan payments.
Really, I'm using my social secretary.
So you're just basically funneling social security money into the medallion.
Exactly.
How long have you been doing that?
This is right now, really, 3 years, almost it start get worse and worse.
So you have $30,000 of debt in your credit card.
Yeah.
You have another, what, $100,000 to pay on your medallion?
Yes, yes.
And you're using your Social Security money pay your medallion.
Yes.
Tax and medallions used to be made available for a nominal fee, but there was a long waiting list. Then in 2010, to make money after the financial crisis, then Mayor Gavin Newsom came up with a plan to start selling medallions. Some 650 taxi driving families took out loans to buy them. Namdev Sharma, another driver, was one of them. He says he lost his home to keep making loan payments. He says he often sits in his cab waiting hours for a fare.
Sit here and wait and wait and get ready for the next day to do the same thing.
Now the medallion program is frozen. Not a single one has sold since 2016. So the drivers are stuck with the medallions and the debt. A court recently ruled that San Francisco is not responsible for the medallion loans made by the local credit union to the drivers, and it doesn't have to forgive the debt. San Francisco's current mayor, London Breed, did not respond to a request for comment. Over 250 taxi drivers who bought medallions have already defaulted on their loans and lost all the money they paid for them. I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a snapshot of us, I guess, from the most recent Gallup poll. The most important problems in the United States right now? Government and poor leadership, say 21% of us, that's the top of the list. Then the virus, immigration. Unifying the country has 7% of us saying that's the most important problem. And then 6% of us say the federal budget deficit. Another 6% say the economy in general. I don't know. What do you think? All right, we're out, but here's your moment of economic context. Got it from Mike Isaac, who covers Facebook for the New York Times. Facebook's legal department sent out a memo last night telling employees to preserve all internal documents and communications going back to 2016. Prudent, one imagines, given the news of late about that company. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Liana Squillace, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Soul to Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Soul to Story are available now.